Hey guys, it's Rhett here, one of your co-hosts for the Awesome Book Club podcast. I just want to thank you guys for joining us for our first ever monthly club meeting. This club was formed as a way to challenge our entrenched beliefs and viewpoints, read some good books that we might not otherwise read on our own, but most importantly, we created this book club to spend some more quality time with our friends. Probably comes as no surprise that this month we're reading Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind from Dr. Yuval Noah Harari. After all, you did click here, but in case you need a filler, Sapiens is a groundbreaking narrative of humanity's creation and evolution that explores the ways in which biology and history have defined us and enhanced our understanding of what it means to be human. Before we get to the podcast, we just want to let you guys know that we recorded this episode in such a way that we've cut it into smaller chunks, but they're all going to be released at once. So once you get to the end of this one, you can find the next episode in the same exact place you found this one. Feel free to chat along with us as you listen along. We're on Twitter. Our handle is @AwesomeBookClub, all one word. Or you can always email us at abc@airpodcast.com. Enjoy the episode, and we'll see you at the end.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Kurt Burney. I am here with Rhett Weisenfels.
Hello, hello.
And Taylor Bouquet.
Hey, guys.
And this is our first ever podcast where we recap a book that we've been reading for the past month. I'm so excited about the book that we read this in October. It was Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. I thought this book was absolutely stunning. I learned a lot about the history of human evolution and a lot of things about what we don't know about why humans are the way that we are that I thought was stunning and awesome. And as the Wall Street Journal says, this book is learned, thought-provoking, crisply written, and fascinating. I'm choosing not to read Jared Diamond's recommendation because that guy is a moron, even though he won a Pulitzer Prize, so whatever. I just want to open it up for some first takes. Rhett and Taylor, what are you thinking about Sapiens after reading it?
Go for it, Rhett.
First of all, I want to chime in with something that I noticed about the Jared Diamond thing real quick. I know that like one of the biggest problems that people have with Jared Diamond is that he's like, hunter-gatherers were happier than we are now. And he stands by that firmly. And what's funny, reading Sapiens, Dr. Harari, Mr. Harari, Professor Harari? I don't know his title. I'm so sorry. He says like the same thing. But what's great about it is he like amends it by, you know, he sort of bookends it by being like, but who can really say? I mean, like, you know, basically, like, now we have washing machines. Like, I mean, he didn't write that, but, you know, like, that's the sentiment. But anyway, my first take of this book, and we kind of talked about it on the intro podcast, which we may or may not air, but, you know, I remember opening it up, and the first thing that I read was about, like, sort of, like, masculinity, like, throughout the ages. And for whatever reason, like that anthropological sort of take on it, like really piqued my interest. And I'll say the book is divided into several parts. And I think the first part overall was my favorite. I just enjoy anthropology and sort of like this ancient history that like we can only speculate on, right? Like there's no writing. There's no books that were handed down because... Yeah, I don't know. But that was my favorite part. I think that the book is extremely well written. And every single point that Harari brings up that is sort of like debatable or like questionable or like even just in your own personal like value system, he always brings it around in a way that A, you can't argue with it, and B, is like totally amenable, right? Like he's not being like a vicious jerk. He's just like, you know, but I guess if you don't believe that, hey, still true, but whatever. And it's like, oh, all right. I guess you can't argue with that. This book had so many like bite-sized quotes, you know, that you can sort of deliver. And when I started reading it, I became like really aware of other people reading it. And in fact, a bunch of my friends were reading it at the same time and were sharing quotes on Facebook. Like, you know, it's like every day he's like, quote of the day from Sapiens. And it's, I really enjoyed that because there are just so many little bite-sized snippets of information that are so poignant and so true. I don't know. I'm, it actually kind of made me excited to read his other book, Deus. I don't know anything about it, but if it's written half as good as Sapiens is, I'm pretty excited. So, I don't know. First impressions, I rambled on a little bit there and wound our way back. But what about you, Taylor?
Yeah, I love the book. And I listened to it twice. I listened to it on audiobook on my way to work and, you know, at times, slow times during work. So the weird thing is I don't think I fully been able to like dissect it and process everything, even with a second listen, because it's just so packed with like everything. I mean, it's the whole history of humankind, you know, that's a lot to talk about. But my biggest take, I feel like, from this is that like today we are the same as we were, you know, back a long time ago in terms of like our impact on the earth and all of its species. Like the one thing that was like crazy to me was how he was talking about essentially Homo sapiens like wiped out Neanderthals. And it was like he said something along the lines of like we were similar enough and different enough for us to kind of hate them and like have a reason to not want them to exist anymore. And it just like I first of all never knew that Homo sapiens and Neanderthals existed at the same time, which was like mind-blowing, you know. And he was talking about how there was interbreeding going on, you know, so we do have Neanderthal DNA in us, which is crazy to think about. But then we also, humans killed them off just like they did so many other species. And I got a lot, well, you know, like recently over the last year or so, my wife and I have become vegetarians. And like after reading this book and the way that he frames humans' impact on animals, just like blew me away at how horrible we are to animals. And the interesting thing I just pulled up, and this might help frame the book a little bit more. I found out that I pulled up his Wikipedia page, and Yuval Noah Harari, is vegan, which actually makes so much sense.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So he's Jewish. He's from Israel. He's openly gay, and he's also vegan. So it gives you a little bit of reference to how he's writing. And now that I know that, it makes a lot of sense. And
yeah, the gayness just seeped into every word, right?
That's not what I mean. It's just like a different perspective than our three straight white guy opinions.
I know,
probably.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So yeah, dude, the book blew me away. It was worth reading a second time, and I actually wouldn't mind getting a physical copy and reading it myself so that I can actually see the words. So yeah, I love the book. There's a lot to talk about. I'm still trying to process everything because it's just so jam-packed with great history, great science, and that matter-of-factness tone, dude.
Yeah.
I wish that there was some authoritarian, like, I don't know, person that could be like, climate change is real. Sorry if you disagree, but that's how it is. Like, just how this guy does it in so many parts of his book, you know? So
I will say that tone, it did make me actually like really begin to question a lot of like the nonfiction that I've read this year, because like, I don't know about you guys, but I have like a really bad tendency of like just, you know, regurgitating information that I have recently learned. You know, I watched a documentary, I read a book, or I freaking read a news article or something. And then I'm out there like evangelizing this new information. And I have a tendency to, like, especially if it's in a book, right? Like, sort of school sort of trained us this way, where we read it on the page, right? It wasn't on the screen. We read it on the page, and it's real. And there's, you know, there's this, I don't know, this like tangible quality to the information. And so it must be true, right? It's been committed to paper with ink. And it's actually made me really question the stuff that I just accepted as true because I read it in a book. And there's quite a few things. I went back and looked at a couple things that I've read. And there is quite a few things that... Like, kind of lost my train of thought here. But there's quite a few things that I've read that I've looked back on that are actually, like,
contended.
Yeah, sort of like contended in like the historical community or science community, things like that, which is interesting because it doesn't mean that you shouldn't value the things that you read. It just means that you gotta sort of, parse the truth and take everything with a grain of salt. I have no problem accepting everything that Harari wrote in this book. But obviously, like, there's a lot of things, especially in like the prehistorical parts, that like are just speculation. And I have no problem accepting like his explanation for things. They seemed very well thought out.
I will say
it was just interesting.
You.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I will say that there are parts that, like, he'll make a statement, and it's just like an oversimplification of like. Capitalism.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like one sentence that describes what capitalism is. And I'm like, while I think I overall agree with that, yeah. Like, that was one sentence that defined this gigantic system, you know?
Yeah. And
so
sorry.
Yeah.
Also, what's funny to me is I had a good chuckle at the beginning of the book because he talks about how old humanity is. I had to look up when the book was published because, you know, I have the hardback copy. It could have come out like, you know, last month for all I knew. But the book was published in 2015. And between then and now, we've actually discovered that humanity is twice as old as he presents it in the very opening chapter of the book.
Interesting.
Which is great. It reminds us that science and history and research are all like moving targets that we should always like strive to hit. And he obviously had like the most up-to-date information on that. But it's funny how like quickly things can change, you know? I think he presents in the book that humanity is like 100, Homo sapiens are 150,000 years old or something like that. And sometime between then when the book was published and now, we've discovered Homo sapien remains in northwestern Africa that are twice as old as the oldest known Homo sapien remains, 300,000 years old, which is amazing when you think about that. That just, like, I don't know, it inspires the imagination for sure.
Totally.
So, Kurt.
Yeah. I that makes me think about one of the really exciting parts of the book for me, which is the idea of the cognitive revolution that happened around 700,000 years ago. Because, well, and overall, I think he does a really good job of saying when he does know something for sure and when he just doesn't know and there's no way to know. And so this 70,000 years ago cognitive revolution, that's basically the idea that at one point, and we don't really know why it happened to Homo sapiens and not Neanderthals that actually had, who had bigger brains than us, or not these other human creatures. We just started being able to think abstractly and form myths and ideas, and it allowed us to cooperate a lot more. And his quote is, "It was a matter of pure chance as far as we can tell," which
like, I love it.
This whole, you know, it blows my mind that the key to Homo sapiens dominance is this thing that was just totally pure chance, and it could have happened to any of the other human species around, and it could have not happened for another 100,000 years, you know, like the timing is so strange. So Rhett, you saying that we're even older than he thought, it's crazy to think there was this period of, you know, let's say 300,000 years where Homo sapiens were just doing their thing and not special at all.
Yeah.
But and they just, this one brain thing hadn't happened. And we don't understand why, and we don't understand why it did. And here we are benefiting from that. So I like, there was an example later on too, where he was trying to decipher the difference between men and women. And he kind of breaks down these three main theories and says, none of these make sense. And then he doesn't offer an alternative theory. He just says, yeah, we don't really know. And then leaves it at that. So I liked, there was a definite difference between things he had no idea of and you know, kind of like making sure we felt comfortable with that ignorance.
There was a lot of like, like integrity to the truth and the ignorance that he presented. Yeah. Like and it comes through on every page.
Yeah. It made me trust him as an author quite a bit. It's a good black, you know, there's a lot of black and white moments. And one of them that I think is very compelling was the one about 6 million years ago, a female ape had two daughters. This is a quote. One became the ancestor of all chimpanzees. The other is our own grandmother. I just thought, whoa, I didn't know, A, how long ago that happened. And B, that we just know that for sure. Or, you know, like, that seemed like a pretty declarative statement that was based in science that I was just like, whoa.
Yeah.
So crazy. Well,
the crazy thing is, too, that it almost feels like religious in that aspect. You know what I mean? It's like, well, Adam and Eve weren't real, yet we did descend from this like one mother, you know, who had two daughters that we branched from, you know. And there are parts that feel like that throughout the book, where it's kind of like you said, where there's just like an absence of I don't know, an absence of a description or
explanation.
That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Which could be led to some, you know, religious theme trying to fill the gap, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because I'm guilty of almost thinking in like religious or like spiritual terms considering like my ancestors, you know, and it's funny because I almost give, I give like more credence to like sort of my genetic like responsibilities and like, you know, to these millions of ancestors that I'll never know and never know their names or their lives or anything. Like I give just as much credence to those people as like, you know, most people who go to church like give the gospels, right? Like, I don't know. I'm not saying that I'm like beholden to any of these people in such a way that like my life is on rails and I can't control my own destiny. But, you know, I do sort of like feel the weight of responsibility to like, you know, not disappoint all of the people that fought so hard for me to like be here. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's, I like thinking about it in that way. Okay, so I'd say overall, and just, you know, to help listeners understand the book, if you haven't read it, it's laid out in a very chronological timeline. Mm-hmm. It starts with, you know, kind of prehistory, very ancient human evolution, which, again, that was my favorite part. I think Rhett said this too, mostly because it was so new. I felt like I just didn't know any of that or very little, and it was stunning. And part two is the agricultural revolution starting in, I think it was 12,000 BC and, you know, kind of moving forward. Part three is the unification of humankind, which talks a lot about empires and kind of like cultures being gobbled up into more, you know, unified and mono cultures and around religion. And then part four is the scientific revolution and kind of the getting to the present and then what's coming next. And maybe it was because each section got more depressing, but I liked it's like my order of favorite sections starts with part one and then goes down from there. It was all fascinating, but it got sad at the end.
Well, like, you know, it's interesting to me when you read, you know, in the part one, they're talking about like how they possibly had the best diet that humanity ever had. And their time was spent, you know, kind of in leisure when you weren't hunting or gathering, like you were exploring or you were swimming or you were climbing rocks or you were doing, you know, you were doing that sort of stuff. And then there's an interesting quote, and I don't want to jump too far ahead because I would love to just kind of go chronologically through the book and we can talk about it. But there is a quote somewhere, and I can't seem to find it in my notes right away, but basically it's that like history is what like a few people make while the rest of us were like, you know, farming, you know, and yes, like eating wheat porridge. Which is, it's sad to think, but you know, he makes this distinction throughout the book that like biologically, these animals that we've domesticated have never done better. And the same can be said of us, right? Like biologically, human beings have never done better because we have such a huge spread of our genes. There's 7.5 billion of us on this planet. Like how amazing that we went from only a handful to now 7.5 billion people. However, like, is it like genetically we're doing great, but how about in every other measurement, right? Like, are we happy? Are we productive? Are we, you know, all of these sorts of metrics, if you take into account, it's like, are we truly better off? You know, if you're eating wheat porridge and working in the farm 15 hours a day, are you, you know, better off than our hunter-gatherer ancestors? I don't know. It's interesting.
Well, and I think that that's the whole theme of the book, personally. Like, it really talks about, like, evolutionarily, and I don't know if that's a word, but that, and, like, in terms of a species as a whole, like, how successful is that species? Like, for instance, you know, pigs or cows or whatever are very populous now, mostly because of humans and domesticating them. And so as a species, technically they're flourishing because there's so many of them. Yet when you like zoom in to an individual level, like how happy are these pigs? What's their psychology like? How much suffering are they experiencing? And when you look at it from those terms, the like everything looks pretty bleak, yeah. Even in terms of humans, you know, like the amount of happiness, like I thought his talk basically on money was really interesting as well. And he kind of, there's one point where he talks about how having more money does actually mean that you're going to be happier. Right. And, but just like zooming in, like the grand scale versus the micro scale are completely different, you know? And,
yeah.
And really the history of humankind is about how much suffering have we inflicted on ourselves and inflicted on other species. And when you look at that, it makes you feel like humans are horrible,
mm-hmm.
like for the history of the earth and all of its species, you know? And that's really what I got out of the book. Was, we're the worst. We've caused so much suffering. And while we've brought up so many other species, we've also decimated probably hundreds of thousands of other species. So kudos to us, guys. Like, great job, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But despite it all, we'll trudge on. We'll hold steady and we'll fix these problems and we'll make the world a better place.
All right.
Yeah.
I don't agree with you, Rhett, but
he says that. Oh, gosh. Well, that's a great overview, Taylor. I think that's very, it's good to start talking about themes and like what we got out of it. Do we want to do some more theme work or just start diving right into part one, the cognitive revolution, and kind of go through the first?
Yeah, let's dive into the sections. I kind of went out of order, my bad. But
No, that's fine, because a lot of these things connect back and forth, like, and they are overarching, and there's a lot of themes and concepts that bridge the whole book.
Yeah. Well, and that idea too, it's kind of like humans, you know, started off like one of any other animal, but as soon as they kind of had that cognitive revolution and they started working as a whole, one unit rather than individuals like animals, things for them did get better in a sense, but then they also started kind of taking advantage of all other animals and species on Earth. You know, so it's basically this slow start to us inflicting suffering upon the rest of the world, you know. And and as time goes on, it's like the curve just goes higher and higher and higher. What's the word I'm looking for?
Exponential.
Exponential, yeah.
Yeah.
We just exponentially inflict suffering upon others through as time goes on. So
it's funny in the, so the, you know, this section is made up of four chapters, and we start, it basically goes from us not existing and being chimpanzees. So basically we start this part one is the cognitive revolution. It starts with humans not existing and ends with us spreading to all continents and wiping out huge amounts of megafauna, including rodents the size of bears in North America.
Yeah.
Which maybe we should have wiped out, because that sounds
horrifying,
absolutely terrifying. But just to think of all of these creatures in the world that we spread and we just kill them all.
Yeah. But
Sorry, Rhett.
No, that's fine. Yeah, we are pretty disappointing in that way. And I always cringe when I think about just like, you know, like, yeah, the megafauna and all of the species that we've eradicated is really sad. I'm even more saddened by just like our own history that we've managed to destroy. I think this a lot, like when I was reading 1491, which is, not to jump into it, but it's, you know, a book about pre-Columbian America and Native American culture and all that sort of stuff. And early on, it talks a lot about the Incas and just like the Incas were pretty amazing, like regarded as like one of the six places that civilization sort of like sprang up independently on its own. And of course, like Europeans just like came over and freaking wiped them out. And like now we hardly know anything about them. It just makes me sad to think about all of our own culture and all of our own history that we've eradicated. And he talks about it at the end of the book, not to jump around too much, but he talks about it at the end of the book, how we view the world through European glasses now, and people wear European style clothes. They enjoy European style music.
Right.
And it makes me sad because, you know, one of the reasons I love traveling is just to get away from that, you know, but you can't anymore. You can't fully escape that. And it makes me really, really sad.
Well, and he also talks about how, also kind of by chance, you know, it could have been any other civilization's, you know, glasses that we see the rest of the world through, but it just happened to be the Europeans. So like, how interesting would it been, or would it have been if, you know, communism was the system that worked, you know?
Yeah.
But instead, we're all about capitalism, consumerism. And because of that, like, societies were brought up into, you know, more wealthy and, you know, kind of better off states, but it always ended up being that someone had to pay the price for that.
Yeah.
You know, which is really sad. Go ahead.
That just makes me, I'm like adding themes as we talk about them. One being a lot of violence that we've inflicted on others and ourselves. And that's kind of what Rhett was talking about. But then also in terms of what culture wins, there's so much chance in this book. I also want to bring this back. But, you know, the title of chapter one is Animal of No Significance. Talking about humans and how we get from out of being insignificant has absolutely nothing to do with our own qualities, which is crazy to me. Just total chance.
Yeah. You know, early on, I was fascinated a lot by the sort of transition of how we began cooperating in bigger and bigger groups. And this is kind of like the focus of the chapters early on, is that like, obviously language was like one of the things that was able to like bind Homo sapiens into being able to cooperating larger. And what was great to me was when he brought in sort of like this science, it's like, yeah, we've sort of discovered that like this is the number of people that like a group can sustain like before language, you know, and it's like a small number. And then it's like after language, it bumps up to this much. And then, you know, with the sort of advent of gossip and the advent of like imaginary systems, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then, of course, it culminates with the advent of money, which then allows us to, you know, not necessarily have to trust an individual, but trust the system. And thus we can cooperate on a global scale. You know,
right.
It's really fascinating how we've gone from groups of 30 to, you know, virtually one group of 7.5 billion. That blew me away. And just the sheer act of talking about, you know, our social tendencies being like what helped forge our ability to congregate into larger groups. That was fascinating to me. You know, how gossip was important even tens of thousands of years ago. Like, it's weird to think, you know, and it's still an important thing today. You know, maybe not in like the negative sense of gossip, but, you know, just like sharing news, you know, being able to get on and watch the evening news and being able to get on Facebook and keep up with people. Like, it is an important part of life, whether or not we want it to be.
Yeah. And talking about how language essentially set us apart from other animals, it was interesting how he described, you know, monkeys do have their own kind of language, but yeah, they don't. And this goes into another theme, which is essentially imagination. And imagination is one thing that really does set humans apart from other animals. And he was talking about how, you know, monkeys or Neanderthals or whatever did have their language. And it was mostly like, you know, they might yell, "A lion is here," you know, which warns the others. And that's really helpful. But humans can specify, "I saw a lion down by the water drinking. You know, be careful,
ago.
Don't go near the river," that kind of thing. But he goes into like also this being able to use your imagination. And one of the quotes that I found really funny was he says, "You could never convince a monkey to give you a banana by promising him limitless bananas after death in monkey heaven." Like,
such
like,
a zing.
And that,
yeah,
it is totally a zing. But that, like, the fact that we have this imagination, like, really helped us as a society, and out of that came religion, you know? The fact that we can imagine why things are the way they are is really powerful, and it, like, brings us together and allows us to kind of create order in a more complex way than, say, the monkeys, who can only just shout that there's a lion, you know?
Yeah. One of the weird things about that for me in reading this was kind of taking an overall, you know, going, stepping back a little bit. You have six types of humans, six species. They're all humans. They're living in different parts of the world. And then one of them, sapiens, just develops that imagination, like you're saying, and then it gives us a superpower, and we can step aside of evolution and just start evolving culture and basically change the entire landscape of the world. But that is totally new. That was totally new for me, the idea that, A, sapiens were around and everyone else was there too. There are all these other human species. But B, sapiens... I just kind of thought once there were sapiens, we were smart and we could do all the things we can do now. But it's crazy to think that there was a version of sapiens, our exact same species, but with a little change in the DNA, and we couldn't think abstractly like that. And we didn't have imagination, and then we weren't anything special.
Well, and who's
for both of you?
Totally new. Yeah. Like when you think about human history, you don't think that we were around the same time as other types of humans. And one thing that stuck out to me was he was talking about, you know, nowadays there's multiple kinds of foxes, and we don't think anything of it. They're foxes, but there are different types of foxes. Like, some of them have bushier tails than others or whatever, you know? And that was the same exact thing with humans, which is like mind blowing. You know, you think that humans, we're just Homo sapiens, you know? That's just what a human is. but that's not how it always was, you know. It was crazy. And when he was talking about like the different kinds, you know, Neanderthals, and then there was, I forget the name of the other one that he talked about that was like kind of a smaller type of human that was on like a particular island.
Yeah.
And they just happened to evolve smaller because of like the amount of resources and stuff there or something.
Yeah.
And there were also smaller other animals there, like smaller elephants and stuff. Yeah, just really strange to wrap your mind around. Because of the notion that there's always just been humans, you know, and I think that's kind of drilled into us, because of the absence of other types of humans, but also because of religion and, you know, Adam and Eve and all that kind of stuff. You just think that like this is how it's always been, you know, and we were made this way on purpose, kind of a thing. At least that's how most people are raised, you know.
You know, here's a question I want to pose to you guys, because. Like Kurt said before, the opening chapter is an animal of no significance or something like that. I don't have it in front of me. But does the fact that like our current state, the fact that like we're sitting here, you know, thousands of miles apart talking about this book, you know, the fact that it's all sort of like chance, you know, all of these, the fact that we're talking in English and, you know, wearing clothes and sitting in a house, basically determined on the roll of some dice. Does that absolve us of like basically trying to like apply any meaning to our existence? Does that absolve us of the of you know, not necessarily the responsibility to do that, but, or does it mean that we have to like try harder to like find meaning? Oh, geez, did I go too deep on you guys?
Whoa.
I don't know if I know. I don't know if I'm fully following you, but.
So the fact that, like, that we're not significant and basically an accident, does it absolve us of our, like, of any sort of, like, responsibility of finding a meaning or, like, a higher purpose to life, you know, whatever that might be?
Like, the fact that it was chance that we're here today, does that mean we're. Our lives are meaningless.
yeah. But like, does it mean that we have like a higher calling to find meaning and to find purpose in our like daily lives? Or do we just sit here and accept things the way they are? It's like, well, here we are. Like, we figured out how to like put, you know, photons through a tube and now we can watch TV, you know?
Well, I just, like he does a lot in the book, I think there's not necessarily an answer to this, but like Taylor was saying, it is the opposite of just the fact that we're not as special as we think we are is the opposite of what we're taught in school and in religion classes, because it's not simple, A, and then it's really kind of sad in some ways because we want to be really special. And I don't know, while you were talking, I imagined other ways the world could work. Because if you're thinking about, let's say it's 70,000 years ago, you have all these six human species with big brains, pigs with pretty big brains, dolphins and whales. Like, what if whales were the ones, or let's say killer whales, that developed imagination and then like destroyed every other creature in the ocean? And built societies and eventually developed ocean farming and then, you know, like came on land and would, you know, hunt things on land and destroy the land. It's totally arbitrary that it was us. And it opens up all of these possibilities that are so numerous that it's like almost more fun to think about what could have happened than it is to think about what meaning or what responsibility we have now. But also all that stuff's just conjecture and play. You know, the question you're asking, Red, is a real, now that we are where we are and we can't go back and there's no changing it, what do we do?
Yeah.
Yeah. And well, I would argue, sorry, Red, I would argue that it actually, like, accepting the fact that we aren't special, gives more meaning to our purpose, I would argue. And the reason for that is, if if we are so special, like continuing on the current state that we are in just makes sense. Like, why change? We're God's chosen people. Like, what should we change? Like, everything we do is perfect, right? Like, you know, we don't, you know, God put animals on the earth for us to use, kind of a thing. And so if you accept that you're not special, then now our purpose is changing that kind of common perception that we're the best, and that, you know, taking advantage of these other species and of the earth's resources and everything is not the right course, you know? And so our purpose now is kind of changing that landscape so that we can make the world a better place and make it more about the things that we've kind of like screwed over our entire lives or our entire history. You know, it's kind of like, what's that called? You know, like after slavery, where we're trying to help African Americans, you know, get back on their feet and have a good life and a good starting place in society because they've been screwed over for so long. You know, it's kind of the same type of thing, except for on a global scale for plants and animals that we've just like destroyed and whatever for so long. You know, now it's our chance to right the thousands of years that we've done wrong, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. And I asked the question, but I almost would even just make probably the case that like the question and the answer, you know, it doesn't even really matter ultimately, which is sad in its own way. You know, people, I think like we live in a time where people, there's enough leeway for people to like absolve themselves of like responsibility, you know, to the species and to the planet as a whole, and absolve themselves of like, you know, like the responsibility of like applying meaning to their own lives and things like that. And hey, you know, like we live in a world where you can do that if you want, I guess. Why would you? I don't know. But yeah, it is interesting. Human beings are crazy. we're just like this crazy, like, I don't know. It's funny. The whole time I was reading this and the whole time we're talking about all this, it makes me think of the Agent Smith quote from The Matrix. He's like, human beings are a virus.
I've thought that for a long time now.
I mean, I don't necessarily think human beings are that bad. And, you know, I mean, I don't hate humanity. I'm not personally responsible for like the choices that have got us here. You know, I'll do my best to like put my best foot forward and like sort of like rectify some of those mistakes of my ancestors and the people that I supposedly share a culture with. But you know, we're all doing the best we can with what we got. So here we are now reading words on paper, ink.
I do this whole like meta conversation about humanity makes me laugh, because one of his points in the book is that we're so obsessed with humanity, and that we've kind of, especially the agricultural revolution got us basically separated from the land, and we needed to then have these gods so we can understand these things we had property over, and we needed ourselves to be gods. And I hadn't thought about this until just now, that this whole book is about us, humanity.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's right at the title.
And it's good to understand, but it's a lot of like navel gazing into all these things we did.
One of my favorite quotes towards the end of the book is, he's like talking about kind of the future of humanity, and he says, "Is there anything more dangerous than dissatisfied and irresponsible gods that don't know what they want?" Which I think is just hilarious, because we've humans have put themselves on this pedestal where they even we even believe that we look like gods, you know, like when we envision what a god is, it's a person, right?
Yeah.
And it's just hilarious because we humans have so many problems and we've given ourselves so many powers, but we don't know what we want. And so like the outlook on our future is very bleak because of that, you know.
It's funny. Anyways. It's funny because God, I want to like rein this back in to get on topic, but I have to say
I know. This. That's how I was too.
It's funny to me because one of the trends in sort of like studying history and anthropology and all of this stuff, one of the growing trends that I really like seeing, well, you know, because I always come to this side of things, like, you know, the nonfiction, the history, the science. I come to this from the camp of like fantasy and science fiction and paranormal and conspiracy theories, right? Like, this is like the bread and butter that I grew up on that like gave me the literacy to like understand the history and the science, as it truly is. But like, so maybe this isn't like this for you guys, but for me, like it's, seems to me that there's this growing trend of like human beings trying to respect the ingenuity and the creativity and the craft and the grit of human beings, right? Like one of the things is that like a lot of people believe, you know, that the Great Pyramids in Egypt were like manufactured or like helped to be manufactured by extraterrestrials, with, you know, and so a lot of people are like, dude, your freaking ancestors built that crap with their bare hands, like give them a little bit of respect, you know. And it's funny because going off like what Taylor was saying about like human beings, like being gods, right, or whatever, it's interesting because like in a way, like we are like the masters of like our own universes, you know, like we people invent entire worlds, like whether it exists on the page or on the screen or whatever, or just ones and zeros. Like it is super fascinating, like the way that we sort of like force our will onto the world, you know. And the Incas cut huge terraces out of these mountains to like be able to grow the food that they needed. And I don't know, while it might have been irresponsible or whatever, it is still very interesting that human beings, like you said, they sort of view gods almost in the same form as them. And I wonder if that's like, you know, is it because like, well, we just couldn't envision anything else, right? Like it's too hard to like talk about this like ephemeral, just like, wobbly, wibbly, gloopy god who has no shape but is like super powerful. Like, nah, he just looks like us. Or is it like, or is that like our sort of like hubris, right? Our arrogance. We're like, we are the gods, bitch. We invented them, so they look like us.
Well, it's like saying that animals don't have souls. We're completely set apart because we are like the gods, right?
Mm. Weird.
Yeah, I. one thought, just I also want to bring this back, but I also don't want to. I woke up this morning and my first thought was, we've developed so much and now we have the power to destroy the entire world and everything that lives on it with nuclear weapons. Was any of it worth it?
Right.
And I've never thought that exact thought before of, wow, we really have gone too far. And like that, I think that is stepping over the line, and it's not going to stop. It's going to get more, we're going to have more powerful weapons, and yeah, you know, we're going to be creating these superhumans that you know, we can talk about later. But
what's really sad is that, you know, that technology can be used for like the absolute betterment of humanity, right? Like,
right.
I was reading not a scientific study, but like a sort of a calculation of like the cost of investing in all these technologies and all this sort of stuff. Like we could have had, God, what is it? Like cold fission reactors? I don't know. I don't have it in front of me, so I'm butchering it. And anybody that's listening is like, you're an idiot. I apologize. But there's this technology called like cold fission or whatever that basically, increase our power output like so much to the point where we could pretty much just like provide free power to like everybody on the planet, which, you know, power is everything in our modern world. You know, once you can absolve yourself of sort of like the cost of like having to heat your home and all this sort of stuff, like then there's just this like world of infinite possibilities. And the fact that like this power is within grasp, but like we just use it to like kill each other instead is like so sad, you know,
yeah.
Like we use it to like control the world and make sure everybody like stays in order. Like, ooh, you don't want the bombs to drop. So let's all just, you know, it's like a Mexican standoff. It's really sad.
But you're so right.
I'll do us the honor of bringing us back. I thought it was very interesting that there's no evidence of trade among Neanderthal remains.
Hey, you made it. Thanks so much for listening. We're going to pick up the conversation exactly where we left it off today. So if you're so inclined, go ahead and pick up the podcast in the same place you found this one, and we'll keep the talk going. But before you go, we want to ask you to please leave us a rating or a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform of choice, and click that subscribe button to keep up with all our new releases. And feel free to give us your opinion over on Twitter. We're at Awesome Book Club, or you can email us at abc@airpodcast.com. Thanks so much, and we'll see you soon.